So this is What's Shaking with Earthquake Science. I'm Craig Miller, science editor at KQED in San Francisco. And let me start by introducing our panel. And let me move this just a little bit closer here. On my immediate right is Richard Allen, who is director of the Berkeley Seismological Laboratory and a professor and chair of the Department of Earth and Planetary Science at U.S. Berkeley. And Richard really has become sort of the go-to guy for talking about earthquake warning systems technology. He pops up in the media immediately after every earthquake, several times, and whenever there's like a seismic-related story, you'll see or hear Richard. We also have with us Joan Gomberg. Joan has come down from specifically, where are you located?
Seattle.
In Seattle, right. It's with the U.S. Geological Survey. I asked her how long she'd been with the Geological Survey, and all she would say is a long time. but her specialty, I wanted Joan to come down because I wanted the idea here was to create a panel that was both that was diverse both geographically and topically, and Joan. Joan's main area of expertise is the Cascadia subduction zone, which is one of the new rock stars of seismology, of course. And yet I think there's still a lot about it that people don't know. One big article, of course, brought it to light. We'll talk about that a little bit later. But I wanted to specifically this panel to be not just about California. So anyway, she's a research geophysicist with the survey specializing in earthquake seismology for the National Earthquake Hazard Reduction Program in the Pacific Northwest. And finally, Raul Walsh has come to us from Stanford. Raul is has done a lot of work with Mark Zoback on induced seismology, man-made earthquakes, which is happening, as you probably know, in Oklahoma a great deal lately. Oklahoma having now overtaken California as the seismic capital of the U.S. And so Raul is a PhD candidate in the Stanford Department of Geophysics, researching man-made earthquakes in the mid-continental U.S. and how to prevent them. So that should be interesting. Mark, by the way, is where did he end up today? He's in Denver doing something. Right?
Yeah, I actually don't know what he's
doing. You don't know what he's doing? Okay.
He doesn't tell us that much.
Okay. So anyway, Raul has been co-author with Mark, and Mark's work, their work together, you know, has actually been relied on by officials in Oklahoma trying to figure out what to do about this. So let me start with, and I'm going to open this up probably sooner than most of these panels do. I'm not going to wait until the last 20 minutes for questions because I want everybody to be involved kind of from the get-go. But let me just start out with each of you with one question. I'll start with you, Richard. And by the way, there's handouts I should mention in the back of the room. There's one from Raul. There's one from Joan. And Richard will be handing out free Android smartphones to every attendee. You'll learn. Did you get that memo?
I didn't.
Oh, I'm sorry. We'll explain what that's about in a minute. But maybe you want to start there and tell us what you're doing with smartphones and earthquake early. I love the phrase early warning because, you know, okay, I'll grant you 8 seconds is warning, but I don't know if it qualifies as early warning. But let's talk about the smartphone technology first. And what you're doing with that?
Sure. Well, thanks, Craig. Thanks for the invitation to be here as well. It's kind of fun to participate in these things, so thank you. So, as Craig said, one of the things I've been working on for quite a while now is earthquake early warning, and it's not that early, seconds to minutes worth of warning. And as many people in the room probably know, we're actually making very rapid progress towards having an earthquake early warning system for the U.S. West Coast, California, Oregon, and Washington. And that system is using traditional, as I now call them, traditional seismic networks and geodetic networks. And we're very close. It's a proven technology. We've issued warnings for past earthquakes, the Napa earthquake perhaps being one of the best examples. And so it's been an effort to get the necessary funding to build that system. We're about a third to a half of the way with funding. So that's the traditional network earthquake early warning system. And I emphasize that because I then want to draw a very bright line between that, which I call a proven technology. It's called Shake Alert. It's a proven technology. And what Craig just asked me about, which is the smartphone effort, which is a research project. But it's a research project that I think has a very significant potential. And the concept is very simple. The smartphone that you all have at least one of right now has an accelerometer in it. And that accelerometer can be used to record earthquakes, just like we do with traditional seismic stations. And so the concept is very simple. If I can figure out how to harness your smartphone accelerometer in order to record earthquakes, then we can possibly record much larger data sets that we can use for a whole range of things. We can use them to understand how earthquake processes affect the built environment. We can possibly use them to understand the earthquake rupture process, so understanding our fundamental understanding of the physics of the process. But also, we may be able to use them for earthquake early warning as well. And so if we can figure out how to harness them, how to process the data quickly enough, then maybe we can use the smartphone accelerometers to provide you with a warning as well. Now, that sounds interesting. It's interesting here in the US, but as I say, we have a proven technology that we're in the process of implementing using traditional networks. But the place that it's really exciting is the rest of the world. Only California and Japan, of all of the earthquake-prone regions, have really dense seismic instrumentation. So the vast majority of earthquake-prone regions don't have that. But if we could use smartphones, of which there are often thousands, hundreds of thousands, then we might be able to bring earthquake early warning to these other regions around the world, and that kind of closes the loop. So I'm asking to use your accelerometer to record earthquakes. Well, what do you get in exchange? Well, what you might get in exchange is earthquake early warning. That's the concept.
Let's move down to Joan, who your subduction zone had its 15 minutes of fame. Was it a couple of years ago when the New Yorker piece came out that ended up winning a Pulitzer Prize, talking about what would happen if there were a major event on that plate boundary up there. But I still think a lot of people don't quite grasp what the whole subduction, cascading a subduction zone thing is. So do you want to kind of give us a quick 101 on that?
Okay. A subduction zone, well, I guess maybe I could ask a show of hands, how many people know what is a subduction zone or what? Okay, so pretty much.
So let's talk about what's unique the Cascadia subduction.
Well, I think one of the things, and we have an effort now, both in the USGS and in the broader academic community, to do more focused work in subduction zones. If you want to work in a place or know about, or if you want places that are sort of the most dynamic interplay between geologic processes and the built environment and society, you need to go to subduction zones. This is where we have the biggest earthquakes, active chains of volcanoes. The conditions make them very prone to landslides and tsunami. We have tsunamis elsewhere, but certainly the biggest and most conducive places for tsunamis are subduction zones. So it's a geological paradise. But as you can imagine, there's a big interplay with the potential hazards that all of these processes cause. So that's why we study in particular in the USGS, where we're pretty hazard-looking. We really focused on understanding the hazards engendered by these processes. That's what makes subduction zones really important and interesting.
Great. If you could pass your mic to Raul, we'll now move on to the other new celebrity of seismology, which is Oklahoma. What do you think, Sarah? Time for new license plates? The whole Sooner State thing has kind of run its course. What, seismic state? Quake state? Yeah, okay. Sarah's working in Oklahoma.
Yeah.
So, Raul, talk about your work with what is going on with all of these earthquakes in Oklahoma. We know it has something to do with reinjection of oil and gas wastewater. What's the status of that work right now? I mean, what do we know?
At this point, we're pretty confident that the vast majority of these earthquakes are induced by water disposal wells. So these are large volume wells that are injecting water that was sucked out of the ground with oil and gas. So they're producing oil or gas from a 360 million year old coral reef. When you suck on a coral reef, you get a gallon of salt water and a cup of oil or gas. And And so the Safe Drinking Water Act regulates how you treat that water, and what it prescribes is that you inject it down a deep disposal well.
And when you say these earthquakes, give us an idea of what we're talking about.
Okay.
If this hockey stick graph
so there's a running count of the magnitude 2.5 or greater earthquakes. That's about approximately the smallest ones that are generally felt. And as you can see, it's gone from about 3 earthquakes a year to more than California. And Oklahoma is in the middle of a tectonic plate, and so it shouldn't have the number of earthquakes that it does, and it's also a considerably smaller state than California.
Okay. Let me stick with you for a minute, Raul, and just ask, why does that not – I mean, there's a lot of – California is a big oil and gas-producing state, and yet it hasn't made headlines here, you know, this induced seismicity. Why not?
Because it's not a problem here. I mean, mm-hmm. in California there is a problem, but it's a natural earthquake problem. Mm-hmm. The not all energy production produces earthquakes equally. In fact, some of the fields that produce the most earthquakes are really not doing very well business-wise. You know, it's not as if you need to cause earthquakes to do well in the energy business or something like that. It's more sort of an accident geologically that this happens than something that comes hand in hand with all oil and gas production.
Joan Gomberg, when that article came out in the New Yorker, what effect did that have on your work? It's still kind of resonating, I guess, right? And what did you think of that article?
Well, as I told you before, it turned our lives upside down for many, many weeks. It's still having reverberations. It raised awareness about earthquakes in the Northwest and subduction zones generally in a way that we've been trying to do for 20 years. It did in overnight. That said, and I have to say, it in many ways, in a positive sense, that awareness has translated into attention that we've been trying to, from Congress, from policymakers, that we have struggled to get. So it shows the power of good journalism, I guess. That said, there were a number of aspects about the article that I think are important to clarify. It was catchy because it really highlighted some of the potential ramifications of a major earthquake. But it is very important to understand that the scenario that it's built around, the purpose of that, and scenarios, earthquake scenarios, so this is a hypothetical earthquake, or what if there was an earthquake, what would happen, was designed for emergency managers. They do exercises and they like to prepare, and they prepare for the worst case. So that what was conveyed in that article is really a worst case, which means it's not the most likely case. In fact, it's an unlikely case. So it conveyed a situation that I think most people would agree is not very likely. It won't be toast east-west of I-5.
You said the last time there wasn't a major event up there was
1700.
1700, yeah.
So it's been a very long time, and clearly it will have major, major, major impacts on not just the Pacific Northwest, but the U.S. economy and so forth. But a lot has been done to prepare. If we look at, I always think the best example is to look at places where earthquakes of that size have already happened. That's ground truth. I think a good analogy is to look at Chile. They had a magnitude 8.8 in 2010 in Chile. They have very similar building codes. It's a relatively developed country. They're very aware of earthquakes.
And yet.
And they had fatalities but not nearly at the scale portrayed. The country continued to function. Even Santiago, which is comparable to Seattle in size and distance, continued to function. So it was a great example of journalism really having a great impact, but not all of it was.
There was definitely some confusion around it. Because working in California, I remember there was the part of the article that said something about there being damage all the way down I-5 or something like that. And I'm sitting in California thinking, wait a minute, I-5 goes to San Diego. You know, there's going to be damage in San Diego from it, you know. And, of course, that wasn't the case. But, you know, there were a lot of things. You know, that article was kind of written to describe what would happen in the Pacific Northwest, such an event. But you did say that when one interesting thing about that plate boundary is when it goes big, you said. There's no little murmurings that kind of remind us that it's there, right?
Yeah, so what I think as you mentioned, one of the reasons it was such a big hit, big splash, is that most people weren't, or a lot of people, particularly outside the Northwest, weren't aware that these major earthquakes, like the kind they had in Japan in 2011, occur. They're inevitable in the Pacific Northwest. And the part of the reason for that is it's a somewhat unique subduction zone, this type of geologic environment, in that the plate boundary where these great earthquakes occur is silent. It does not make little earthquakes, unlike Japan, which has frequent magnitude 6s and 7s and 8s. It has almost no small earthquakes. So it appears, for reasons that are really just matters of speculation, that when it goes big, and that's all. So it will sit there making no earthquakes for decades, possibly hundreds of years or more, with just no earthquakes at all. And so we really didn't even know that it was capable of making big earthquakes until about 15, 20 years ago. And that's a somewhat unique feature of the Cascadia.
And Richard Allen, and for our latecomers, Richard started out talking about some of the sort of cutting-edge technology that they're working with smartphones to try to gather earthquake data, and that could eventually lead to a warning system on everybody's smartphone. But until that day comes, Richard, why is it taking so long to get a fully deployed, functional warning system in California, the seat of high technology in Silicon Valley? Japan has it. Mexico has it. Why don't we have it, and when are we going to get it?
Yeah. The good news is, and I've only really started saying this in the last 2 or 3 months, I'm very confident now that we will get it. The process of actually funding, I've only just now in that, and the process of getting the funding is moving us forward. So we're not there yet. It's clearly several years away. But to the question of why, it's sort of similar to, I think, what Joan was talking about, that people just, it's easy to forget that even in California, where the earthquakes are not every 300 years, they're every few decades. People easily forget what the hazard is. We passed a law in California in 2013 saying that California should have an early warning system. So it got up to the point where it was fully supported, but there wasn't a single dollar committed to actually doing that. So it's the issue of, even when we talk to legislators about it and they recognize the reality of the earthquake hazard, and the need to do something, and the fact that this technology can actually help, it's how immediate is the issue. But I'll link it back to what Joan was just talking about, this New Yorker article. The White House held an event to promote earthquake preparedness, and early warning played a prominent role in that White House summit in February. And I can tell you that that summit was spurred by the New Yorker article being read in the West Wing and National Security Council taking it seriously as opposed to the science. So there's this interesting process where, as scientists, as Joan was saying, we have been trying to explain what the risks are, what the hazards are, not getting very far, frankly. But then when this article came out, again, the power of journalism, All of a sudden, a whole different group of people started to look at this, think about this, the National Security Council, and that's really, I think, what's helped propel us forward.
So time horizon on this. Right.
So that's the big question. The challenge with answering that question is that the funding is not yet in place. So I said, depends on how you measure. There's need for ongoing operating costs. There's need for build out. The ask has been made both at the state and at the federal level. The good news is that the operating cost is about $16 million per year for the whole West Coast system. Last year, Congress allocated $8.2 million, up from $5 million the previous year. So that's kind of like halfway there. And then the build-out cost is about $38 million total. It's $23 million here in California. And sat on the governor's desk right now is legislation that puts in the necessary management framework, which would then also release $10 million that the governor has put to one side.
But you're having to raise private money to get this job done, right? Now, a colleague of mine made, I think, an excellent analogy and said, that's like saying we're going to build a 911 emergency system, but you have to go raise money from corporations and foundations for it. I mean, this is a major public safety question. Why isn't it 100% funded with public money?
I'm not sure I'm the one to answer that question. I agree, obviously. I think it should. There's been a push all along that this should be a public-private partnership on various fronts. And I'm hopeful. We're told that in California that there are some groups who are now ready to start contributing. So hopefully that will get us over that hurdle.
And I'll bet, as I said earlier, I'm going to open this up, you know, instead of waiting for the last 20 minutes. And I'll bet Sarah has a question for Raul.
I have a question for everyone. So,
identify yourself.
Sarah Terry Cobo. I'm an energy reporter with the Journal Record. It's a business newspaper based in Oklahoma City. Cover a lot of earthquakes. But my question is for the whole panel. Dr. Gromberg, you mentioned the attention raised, the kind of raised people's awareness and the need for money. And so I'm curious, how fast, for all of your research, how fast are you getting that money? How much money do you need to create a more denser seismic network or an early warning system or whatever it is that you need, Dr. Gromberg? And how do you feel about industry or private money funding that denser seismic network or whatever else if you can't get it from the government?
Well, she started with you, John. You want to take a shot at it, and then we'll pass it around.
Well, I guess I didn't. Of course, we always need. The USGS has been basically flat funded the earthquake component of it for many years now, and as you'd imagine, costs go up and so on. So our capabilities have been diminishing. In fact, a big need and frontier, and now that the technology has caught up. A big part of subduction zones, the geologic action happens offshore. And that's a very expensive place to work, but is a place where we have a big gap in the observations that we can make, and thus what we know. So that's a place where we really need a big boost, and it is very expensive, many millions of dollars, but we'd take just a few even. As far as public-private partnerships, a key thing I think in that is, again, we probably take wherever we can get some contributions, but the important thing is that many of, at least certainly for monitoring and a lot of these early warning, and these are long-term investments. So even if you get an infusion from a private company, you have to maintain that. Over these require sustained efforts, and you know, if that's possible with a private partnership, that's great, but that has to be a key element. It can't be just a one-shot deal for most of these purposes isn't that useful.
And do you know how much money you would need to really, like, say, build out this this ocean floor sensor network that you're doing, or create a really reliable tsunami warning system out there?
Oh, gosh. Richard, you have a
bit. Well, I know. The number that I think is there for a full... So Japan just deployed a cabled observatory following the Tohoku Oki earthquake. So offshore eastern Japan, they deployed a seafloor sensor network in order to record earthquakes, to study the science of the earthquake process, and also to deliver more rapid early warnings. And so there are proposals out there to do something similar in Cascadia, but the cost is about $500 million. So it's extremely expensive to do.
Although, that said, when you compare that to the losses in just a single earthquake, it's really very small. So it seems like a really big numbers, but when put in perspective, it's really not. It's very doable.
Raul Walsh, let me ask you a money question. Sort of from the other end of the telescope in Oklahoma. I think I heard when I was there, Sarah can confirm this. Like 1 out of 5 jobs is tied to oil and gas. So you're doing all this great research. You're telling them, here's what's happening. You're injecting all this wastewater back into the ground. It's causing these earthquakes. Do you feel like how would you assess the response so far to that?
I've gotten every response.
Move up and on.
I've gotten every response you can imagine. I'm different. My situation is different from the other panelists in that I'm a student, so it's not my job to find funding. It's my advisor's job to find funding. My situation is also a little different in that nearly all of my research is industry funded. It's a research consortium where energy companies that want this problem solved because it's frankly an inconvenient problem pay a sort of yearly subscription or something like that. So I work with the companies very closely and I had no idea what to expect, but I've been pleasantly surprised with the sort of quality scientists and engineers I get to work with. And so...
Do you sense any conflict in that? You said it industry-funded. What industry? Who actually...
Energy industry.
Energy industry. So there might. Do you feel any pressure to come up with answers that they might want?
I'm lucky in that I don't... I'm funded by them, but I don't have sort of deliverables to them or anything like that. I
enjoy
feel,
that while you can.
I feel like I have total academic freedom. They certainly haven't liked all of the work I've done, but I do see the awkward position. If you view it as an us versus them, and I'm sort of in the middle as a scientist, I totally see how that could be construed as awkward. I haven't felt that, but I could see how it could be construed as that.
We had a question first on this side in the back. And identify yourself.
My understanding, so the public-private partnership is still something that's been put together in the state of California, and the group that I think is actually sort of is closest to being ready to contribute, as I understand it, is actually the utilities companies rather than the insurance companies. I agree that you would think that insurance companies would want to get involved, and maybe they will. You know, we have to understand that while this has kind of been around, I mean, I've been working on this for a number of years, so it's the most natural thing for me, but this is a very new technology for a lot of people, and people don't understand what's possible, and I think it takes a certain amount of time for people to understand the potential and actually fully realize what the potential is. We don't fully understand all the uses and all the benefits of early warning. So I think that the process that we have, where we have a production prototype system running right now with a group of test users, and so that's allowing people to start figuring out the uses, and hopefully that will enable some other groups to get more involved in the project as they realize what's going on.
Raul, I want to add, because for those of you playing catch up on the Oklahoma situation, can you just kind of describe the mechanics of why reinjecting this wastewater is causing earthquakes? Raul has you can find it on YouTube. He has a presentation where he has a great animation that explains all this. But since we don't have that here, we'll do shadow puppets or something.
Okay, and yeah. You can the best physical analogy is table, you know, if I were to lift the end of this table up a few degrees and put a hockey puck on it, the puck would want to slip, but it wouldn't because there's enough friction. If I lift the table high enough, it'll slip. That's like a natural earthquake, you know, when the table gets steep enough, it slips. An induced earthquake, as we're observing them in Oklahoma, is more like me telling you it's an air hockey table, not a regular table. And so the injection wells are essentially unclamping the interface between the puck and the table and allowing
it to allowing
a fault to slip if it sort of wanted to but couldn't get over the friction.
Right here in front.
Janet Rollins with Science News. If the New Yorker article was very useful in catalyzing discussion, potentially policy and maybe even money, isn't there a lesson in that for scientists that you guys should be using some of those techniques when you are trying to, you know, compel people about the importance of the work you're doing and not rely on us to do it?
Techniques such as?
I mean, I don't know. There's always this reticence of, you know, the science community to talk about the implications of their work. They're super cautious, and I understand wanting to be super cautious, but haven't you learned that maybe if you want to be able to do your work, you need to be a little more speculative about the implications?
Anybody want to take
that?
Raul?
I would say yes.
There's certainly some lesson there, but it's, you know, we're sort of trained to be hesitant that if you shout for everything, then no one takes you serious for anything. So that's something we maybe err too cautiously on, admittedly.
Yeah, I think there's certainly lessons in there, and I suppose I would turn it around and ask, you guys are the professionals, the experts in information transfer, is we're still struggling to understand what was it about that article that made it so compelling. I certainly personally don't have the understanding of why was that so. If we knew that, you know, it would be really useful to get, I guess, to get your input on what
made that go viral, yeah. In other words. Yeah. Richard, sounds like you have a...
Yeah, I mean, it's a really interesting kind of proposition that you're putting forward, that we should be out there writing... What you're sort of saying is we should potentially be out there writing this kind of article that we saw in The New Yorker. And I'm not sure that... I think that's problematic, because I think that what Catherine did was take the science and laid out a compelling case that people could relate to. And I think that that's a great thing for a journalist to do. But as for us as scientists, I think our job is a little different, which is to actually be able to lay out all of the caveats and all of the... So what this means is that there has to be an effective partnership between the scientists and the journalists. And I would say that... I wasn't in the Pacific Northwest. I will say I think that article was one of the best things that happened for understanding earthquake hazard. I mean, public understanding of earthquake hazard in the Pacific Northwest. Of course, I completely understand Joan's concerns about some aspects to it. But there's, as you say, or somebody said, there's a balance to be struck here. But I think that there does need to be this dividing line. The scientist's responsibility is to lay out all of the caveats. And what we need is help from the journalist community to actually then take these pieces and put it together in an appropriate fashion for the public.
But we can only do that if we know what what the implications are. And
right.
If you're so cautious that we don't see what those are up front, you're not helping us, you know, and sort of speculating if-then situations, a number of if-then situations. We can go from there, but if you don't give us the if-thens, it's hidden, and it's just on the shelf, right?
I just want to echo Richard's comment about there needing to be clearly a better partnership between journalists who are the experts at conveying information and the scientific community. A lot of scientists are not very good communicators, and is it... In my opinion, it's not really reasonable to expect that they can be everything, that they can be both good scientists, which perhaps by nature means they're not necessarily going to be great communicators, and do, you know, be great public speakers and writers and all this. That's why we have, so there needs to be, this needs to happen through a partnership, and obviously there's a lot of room for improvement.
And Joan Gomber, you pointed out that that the author of that article went with the worst case scenario, but let's talk about just the sheer size of a likely event. When you said it goes big, compare an event up there, a likely event up there, to the potential to something that might happen on, say, the San Andreas Fault.
In terms of, I guess, what's the biggest earthquake?
An eight.
So the largest earthquake on the San Andreas is forecast to be a magnitude 8.
And that's just 1906?
1906. And that's really, that's a physical limit. You need a big fault to make a big earthquake.
And note to journalists, we don't use the Richter scale anymore, right?
Great. Okay. The biggest earthquake we're likely to have in Cascadia is a magnitude 9. That is enormously bigger.
How many times bigger than an 8 is a 9? Because it's a logarithmic scale, right?
Right. So it's, 30 times? The energy is about 30 times greater. Think the earthquake, and again, I think the best example is look at previous earthquakes in similar environments. Think the earthquake in Japan in 2011. Fortunately, we don't have a nuclear power plant on the coast. Think the same thing.
I'm sorry. What was the, something? What was the murmuring bubbling up from back there about the nuclear? Can you identify yourself? Yeah, I think Dr. Gomberg was simply saying there aren't any coastal nuclear power plants in Washington or Oregon, right? That was your point.
That's right. Yeah. There's nothing analogous in the same geologic environment and in the Pacific Northwest to Fukushima.
I promise I'll get to you guys, but I think you had your hand up here.
Yeah, just to go back to the New Yorker article, Nancy Lord from Alaska, and I teach science writing and so I've had my students analyze that article on strengths and weaknesses, and I just thought it might be interesting for you to hear.
Okay, hold that question. I need to abide by the rules here. Are there any journalists that have that still have questions? We have to run through the journalist questions first. I'm sorry. Okay, all right, sorry. Okay, go for it.
Can I ask very quickly, wasn't a very big piece of the success of this article one single quote, and that was the quote from the FEMA chief that everything west of I-5 will be toast. And, you know, it's sort of interesting because it's very easy for us to argue that that's a very irresponsible quote, but clearly it drove the article. And I don't know. Comes back to the question a minute ago about the right balance here.
Third row back. That's you. Yeah. And I'm falling down on the job here. I'm supposed to be repeating the questions, and I've been forgetting to do it. But, yeah, what about that Richter scale? How come we changed it, and what are we using now?
So it's kind of – I would describe it as a detail. It doesn't offend me when people refer to the Richter scale at all. So the Richter scale was the original magnitude scale, and the Richter scale was based specifically on how you measure the size of earthquakes. And, in fact, it was tied to a very specific instrument, the type of instrument that was first deployed out across Southern California, a Wood Anderson instrument, and, you know, it was about relating the number of centimeters of motion on this instrument to the distance to the magnitude. So that was the definition of the Richter magnitude. And so now, of course, we don't use those instruments, obviously. Things have moved on. And so now we instead use a moment magnitude scale. And the moment magnitude scale we prefer because it's a better representation of the earthquake process itself. However, the reason it doesn't matter too much is that the moment magnitude scale has been selected to be very similar to the Richter scale, certainly at lower magnitudes, and it does a much better job at the higher magnitudes. So it is true that we don't use the Richter scale, but of course that's always what's portrayed. But I also understand this again comes back to what's the purpose here. The truth is that the public understands when you say Richter magnitude, they understand that. And if you just say moment magnitude, they won't. So it doesn't offend me.
The common nomenclature now, accepted nomenclature, is to simply say a magnitude 7.5 earthquake or something like that.
Okay.
Back here in the white shirt. Yeah. Is that the 5.6?
5.8.
The question I have is, can an earthquake in Oklahoma disrupt faults? Because we're all paranoid about the New Hampshire fault in the St. Louis area. Can it have any kind of impact on natural faults?
Okay. Can Oklahoma seismic activity impact natural faults further afield?
There is a phenomenon that we do understand where an earthquake can remotely trigger another earthquake, but it's an extremely low probability occurrence.
Okay. And blue shirt there.
Yeah, James can ask a question for Raul. The New Madrid earthquake zone is in a really thin place in the center of a tectonic plate. What geologically, which is why that shakes a lot, what geologically makes Oklahoma so prone to this? Why other places that have fracking not have the same earthquake?
And if you're asking about New Madrid, I would point out that Dr. Gomberg spent a lot of time on that as well, and so she's a good source for.
Yeah, so a couple things.
What was the question?
So the first part of the question was about the weakness in the crust around New Madrid. That's something that's debated. It's my personal opinion that it's entirely reasonable that the tectonic plate is slightly weaker at New Madrid. So if you push or pull the tectonic plate from various places, that's where it'll sort of bend or break first, if you will. There are some geologic similarities between central Oklahoma and New Madrid, but it's Oklahoma. If New Madrid is the chink in the armor, Oklahoma is not as weak or not as big of a chink, if you will. What's happening is where the geologic setting is such that the faults that can cause these earthquakes are the fluid is making its way into them. So one of the things we advise the companies is if you can find a layer that's isolated, you know, rocks are laid down in layers horizontally often. So if you can find a layer that won't pressurize the deeper faults, that's one thing that's one example of a thing they can do to mitigate this.
Dr. Robert, did you want to do anything on New Madrid? Any comments on New Madrid
specifically? No, I think
he covered it. Yeah. You did tell. You were explaining though that the Madrid is just a weird place to have a major earthquake because it's not on a plate boundary, right? Like what we have out here. So I mean, is it something of a mystery why? Because there was a big one there in 18. What do we say?
11 and 12.
Yeah, 11 and 12. Yeah.
Yes, it
rang church bells in Boston. They say.
It is a mystery, and as by all our. You know, the basic theories of plate tectonics, you should not have major earthquakes inside in the middle of a tectonic plate. And we know pretty definitively that not only were there major earthquakes there in 1811 and 12, in fact, it was a sequence of three earthquakes of roughly the same size, plus many more, but these episodes of recurrent earthquakes have happened at least twice before. So it's not a one-off event. Now, whether there'll be more or not is totally a matter of an open question.
And the other sleeping giant is there's a major subduction zone in the Caribbean, too, which we never hear about, which could have major impacts on, Puerto Rico, Florida.
Right, so most people have heard of the Ring of Fire, which is also I learned is a movie about music, but at any rate, I think most people have heard of the Ring of Fire with reference largely to the volcanoes that ring the Pacific. But we also have major subduction zones in the Caribbean. That's very complicated geologically, and probably the rates are slower. But certainly a major earthquake, which have been documented there geologically and historically, could impact, for example, the eastern seaboard.
Via tsunami?
Via tsunamis, that's right.
Let's see. Gentleman back here in the, right there.
Me?
Gray jacket, yeah, you.
Okay. Neil Strassman, formerly the environment writer at the Star Telegram in Fort Worth.
Okay,
now
Fort Worth.
We're at the in Fort Worth, we're at the very bottom of this earthquake zone that's extended all the way up into lower Kansas. And when that 5.3 or 6 earthquake happened, it was the strongest of all that had happened along I-35 there. And I was looking at this chart, and the bottom chart shows just a whole lot of injection well activity.
So the question is, are they shutting? Is shutting down injection wells going to help at the rate that they're doing it in Oklahoma?
That's a hard.
And how many wells are there? By the way, just for the record, I'll bet Sarah knows. Maybe Raul knows too. How many wells in Oklahoma?
There are thousands. I don't remember the exact number.
Injection wells. Roughly 3,000 to 4,000.
Yeah, right.
So is shutting down 30 or 60 going to make a difference?
The short answer is I don't know, and part of it is it's not my role to sort of comment on these regulatory matters per se. It's my role to sort of understand the physics, so I'm not really the best person to ask. You know, so I hesitant to tell you if it's enough or not. I hesitate to tell you if it's enough or not enough or something like that, but it's sort of the decision the regulators make based on the information.
Well, I don't think it was a regulatory question. I think it's a seismology question. I mean, is shutting down 30 out of 3,000 or 4,000 wells going to make a dent in the lifting the table?
So one of the big questions is that many people are asking scientifically too is, you know, when you shut down these, what they're doing is they're drawing a circle or a sausage shape around a fault and shutting the wells off within a certain radius and limiting the volumes within a certain larger radius. So one of the questions is, to what degree is the well just being, the water being trucked right outside of that radius and put into the next well? And so you have all these sort of complicated feedbacks where it's not, again, you know, it's not clear if much is actually changing, even based on these regulations. But that's not to say that, you know, to the other counterpoint is if we're pretty sure these wells are causing the earthquakes, then does shutting wells down hurt the process? It probably doesn't. But how much does it help is the open question.
And back here in the middle. Yep.
So if injecting wastewater into the earth causes earthquakes, what about carbon sequestration? Injecting, like, the coal industry is talking about
carbon capture and sequestration. And sequestration. There's not much of it happening. <That's> yeah. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Is injecting CO2 back into the ground as being proposed on a large scale have the same effect?
Yes, that's a great question, and you're onto something in that injection often does cause earthquake. Okay, that's not fair to say. injection can cause earthquakes. I know of, in general, they're very small magnitude, but it is a legitimate risk to large-scale carbon capture and storage. When you're injecting CO2 into a rock, it's easy to forget that there's already something in that rock. There's already water in that rock. CO2 can compress, but water doesn't really compress very much. So it gets into chemistry and things like that. But as an example of your question, I do know there's a pilot CO2 injection project in Decatur, Illinois, where they are observing very small magnitude earthquakes, and they're monitoring them. It's a partnership with the State Geological Survey and I think Archer Daniels Midland. And they're monitoring small earthquakes in a pilot CO2 injection project. So that's a case where we do observe it, yes.
So California, let's say, where they're starting to decarbonize aggressively by regulation, starting to look at emissions from oil and gas production, let's say that industry turns to carbon capture and storage as a solution to that, does California now potentially have an Oklahoma problem? Or is the geology just so different that we don't know, or it wouldn't be the same?
Yeah, if anyone were proposing any particular CO2 injection problem, it would certainly be a question that I would raise that should be looked into. One way to get around it, and, you know, we're talking about places with oil and gas fields, is to pump CO2 back into a field that you've already produced oil or gas from. Because the earthquake problem generally, not always, but often it occurs because you're raising the fluid pressure above where it was naturally. So a logical approach is to go somewhere where you've already decreased the pressure by sucking oil or gas out of the ground and then store CO2 there. Okay. And sometimes they even do that to get more oil or gas out of a given field.
Sorry, you were waiting, I think, or did you have still, or was it answering? That's all right. Okay.
Evolved so quickly, and if you could give an example of what that means for your research. I had a geology professors say what we know about Oklahoma's basement rock has changed in the last 3 years more than it has in the last 50 years. So how is science evolving rapidly, and how does that affect your work?
Okay. I think that's probably on the recording. How is science evolving rapidly and affecting your work? I guess any of them? Okay. Richard Allen?
Talking about Oklahoma, I mean, I'll give you an example. It comes back to the cell phone project I mentioned at the beginning, which I didn't name. It's called MyShake, and you can download the app at myshake.berkeley.edu.
Not if you have an iPhone. When are we getting our iPhone?
It's only available for Android, because there are millions, there are many more Android phones, but the iPhone version is coming.
All right.
I expect you to write a piece about it when it comes out. Actually, this has been interesting. The reason I bring this up again is, you know, in Oklahoma, MyShake actually has a whole bunch of phones that are recording earthquakes. And so the magnitude 5.8 earthquake two weeks ago at this point was actually a great example for us of the power of using this technology, because I forget now the numbers exactly, but I think we recorded 50 waveforms for that magnitude 5.8 across Oklahoma. And these were all on phones were people's personal phones that detected the earthquake, triggered, and sent the waveform data to us for analysis. So that's an example of how, you know, as these various processes, as these things occur, we can actually use them to push the science forward.
And yet we're behind in so many areas. Even the basic fault mapping project of California is like way behind, isn't it? And what's going on with that?
Yeah, so you're talking about the SCEC CSEP project to actually understand all of the earthquakes, all of the faults in California. I think I'm not sure how incomplete it is. I think we have a very good set of fault maps in California at this point. The effort to understand what that means in terms of hazards with the geologic survey is something that's still going on. I think that we're in a pretty good place in understanding what the likely faults are. And so now it's really about understanding the variations in ground shaking that we might see for different types of events.
But a couple of years ago, when we had a six-pointer in Napa, that took a few people by surprise, right? Because that was an example of not really knowing what's going on under there.
Okay, yes. So that Napa fault, I mean, it was a known fault. It was a mapped fault that it occurred on, but it was not one of the faults that we consider to have a high probability of a rupture. That's correct. When you look in the Bay Area at the faults that we think are very high probability, it's very simple. It's the San Andreas fault, and it's the Hayward fault. There are other faults, but they have much lower probabilities. The Napa fault had a very low probability. So the question then becomes, does that mean that the science is failing, that we didn't know that it was likely to have an earthquake on that fault? And I don't think it's fair to say that. These probabilities, these are all probabilities. You know, the highest probability is approximately a 30% likelihood of a big earthquake on the San Andreas or the Hayward fault, specifically in the San Francisco Bay Area, and then lower probabilities on other faults. But when you look at the distribution, the predicted distribution of ground shaking, it actually captures things like the earthquake on the Napa fault. So it's true that the Napa was not considered to be a high hazard fault, but when it comes to actually understanding the likely ground shaking, that was accurately captured, I would say.
What probable scenario or possible scenario of a seismic event in California worries you the most?
This is the M9 versus the M8 sort of battle, arm wrestle or something.
It's more than just the San Andreas.
It is. So, you know, in there are several hazards that I think we have to be really, or several specific scenarios that we should be very concerned about. I'm going to start with the one that's closest to home for me, and that is a magnitude 7 on the Hayward Fault. The Berkeley campus is right on top of the Hayward Fault. My office is 400 feet from the Hayward Fault.
You get no warning.
So, no. If it depends where the earthquake starts, okay. I may or may not get a warning depending on where the earthquake starts. So that scenario, a magnitude 7 on the Hayward Fault, is a very scary scenario. It is it's a more likely scenario in this. The spectrum. Joan was talking about the fact that the magnitude 9 scenario in the New Yorker piece was the N-member scenario. Magnitude 7 on the Hayward Fault is you know, pretty much in the middle of the sort of scenario spectrum, I would say. And it's a scary scenario because of the number of people who live directly on top of the Hayward Fault. Basically, the Hayward Fault runs right down the East Bay. It's at the base of the hills in the East Bay. And so the entire population of the East Bay live within a mile or two of that fault.
And
so
that's all the major medical facilities.
All of the major medical facilities are scarily close to the fault. Okay, another big scenario, of course, is a large earthquake on the San Andreas Fault. That will be very similar, but on the other side of the bay. And not to leave out Southern California, there's a couple of scenarios there. One is the really big earthquake, a magnitude 8 earthquake that starts at the southern end of the San Andreas Fault and ruptures up to the north, which will pack a real punch in the Los Angeles Basin. Although the Los Angeles Basin is not on the fault, the shaking energy from that earthquake gets poured into the Los Angeles Basin. But perhaps an even more scary scenario, although less likely perhaps, is a rupture on one of the smaller faults that is right underneath the Los Angeles Basin. So that's something similar to the Northridge earthquake. That's what happened in the Northridge earthquake. Although in the Northridge earthquake case, most of the shaking was actually north of the Los Angeles Basin in the Santa Susana Mountains. An event like that, where the shaking is actually in the Los Angeles Basin, is a very scary event.
Mm-hmm. Question back here, all the way back, white shirt.
I couldn't answer that question. So,
can anybody answer that question?
I
Thank you. What's the probability of another earthquake in Napa?
Depends on the magnitude, right?
Yeah, I mean, it depends on the
Okay, the probability of a major event.
So I think that the answer to that question is frankly the same as the answer to that question before the Napa earthquake, which is that in the San Francisco Bay Area, there's a 2 in 3 likelihood of a major damaging earthquake. Okay, so that's sort of the short version. The sort of more detailed version is I'm talking about an earthquake greater than a magnitude 6.7 on one of the faults in the sort of the greater San Francisco Bay Area, which includes Napa. And so these are the probabilities that come out of the working groups for probabilities in California, the USURF reports. And so that was the assessment before Napa. It's still the same assessment after Napa.
Do you have a sense, Richard, that we're prepared for a 6.7 in the Bay Area?
Are we prepared for a magnitude 6.7? I can tell you at the time of the centennial of the 1906 earthquake, there was a lot of studies done as to the degree to which the Bay Area is ready for a big earthquake. And one of the numbers that really stuck with me was that less than 10% of people living in the San Francisco Bay Area had done anything to be ready for an earthquake. That's truly horrifying because this is something that is going to happen in the course of the next 30 years. This is something that's going to happen likely while I own the house I currently own in the San Francisco Bay Area. So the idea that less than 10% of people had done anything is really quite alarming. And so I think this comes back to sort of, as Joan was talking about earlier, getting people to understand what the hazards are and take them seriously remains a real challenge.
Let's see. I'll come back to you. Let's go with someone who hasn't had a chance. What can people do to prepare?
So the first thing is to think about, as an individual, what are you going to do to prepare? And the simple answer is to have your own preparedness kit, to have a plan for what you and your family are going to do in an earthquake. The next stage is to think about the buildings that you spend a lot of time in. So that would be your home and your office primarily. What's the likelihood that those buildings are going to be damaged and potentially injure you during an earthquake? And then the final step, I would say, is to start trying to educate the people around you to also go through that kind of process. And that's how you sort of build a more resilient community as a whole, by starting local, and local being me, and then expanding out to the more global, the global being my block.
What about in terms of retrofitting buildings and elevated freeways and things of this nature? Is that moving along, in your opinion, apace, or is that behind?
So retrofitting is, of course, part of the thinking about the safety of your home and your office. So that's the retrofitting's in that. the safest way to deal with this problem is to live in a building that has been built relatively recently. As I like to tell my students, the two dates I teach a very large format undergraduate class, and one of the key things I want them to know is that there are two key dates when it comes to earthquake safety. It's 1976 and 1995, and that's when the really big changes in building codes occurred. So if you're in a building that was built after those dates, after 95 or after 76, there's a big step function improvement in the safety of the building that you're in. So for the older buildings, then the only possibility is replacement or retrofit. I can't comment on the degree to which people have done that. I don't think retrofitting is done very widely. I can tell you that UC Berkeley actually took this very seriously. Berkeley expanded rapidly at a particularly unfortunate time when it comes to buildings in the 1960s and 70s, i.e. before 1976. But Berkeley actually then recognized that this was a serious issue. The thing that made campus administration take it seriously was when it was pointed out that a damaging earthquake on the Hayward Fault would probably have such serious damage across the campus that the university would probably not survive, as in people would move away because they have to immediately and they would never come back. And so they started a retrofit program, and they've now spent over $2 billion retrofitting the UC Berkeley campus. That's very impressive, I think. So more groups doing, more institutions taking that kind of approach would clearly make a big difference.
Questions? I thought there was one back here. All the way back. Great. Have the building codes in Cascadia Zone kept pace? Richard was talking about California primarily.
This is out of my area of expertise, but my understanding, it's building codes are largely a they even go by the city or county basis. So I think in some, certainly in the major cities, they're probably something, there's an awareness, and many of the building codes have been updated and adopted. This sort of gets back to the previous question about what can be done in places, particularly places that aren't California, is advocacy for legislation and funding to do large-scale retrofitting programs to public facilities in some ways may make a bigger contribution to public safety than what one individual can do in their own home. It's certainly important. But so there are, I know that there have been attempts, there's an effort underway in Portland, for example, to do a retrofitting program. Portland is full of what we call unreinforced masonry buildings. Those are the most vulnerable in shaking. It's pretty clear if shaken strongly, they're going to come down. And these are the quaint old buildings that we want to preserve. That costs money. So a similar effort started and then stopped by the city of Seattle. Advocating for those kinds of things can go along. And the building codes following or setting up the legislation required and building codes that require the right measures will go a really long way. Yeah, but I suspect, again, I'm reaching a little bit, that in most of the urban areas, the building codes have at least caught up with that understanding that, yes, there are modern seismic design provisions and that the building codes account for them. The thing to remember about building codes is all they are meant to do is ensure that the building remains standing, that it's not going to crush you. It does not mean in any way that the building will remain operable or useful afterwards. It is a bare minimum for life safety. And I think most people are surprised as well. My building was built to the building code. Why is it useless now? And that's the intent of the basic building codes, is strictly to keep things standing.
The case of a hospital is a prime example of that. You know, if the building is intact but everything inside gets shaken up and trashed, the hospital's of no use, and which is why in parts of California there are actually some hospital companies have actually elected, rather than retrofit their old buildings, to tear them down and start all over again and put them on, you know, shock absorbers and other types of, you know, earthquake mounts that will that allow the building to move and the contents to still remain intact, you know, even at the building. Let's see. We're into repeat questioners now. Anybody has not asked a question that would like to? Okay, we're good to go. Let's go back to the gentleman in the... How do injection wells differ from the actual production wells?
So there are over 100,000 of these wells operating in the U.S., and they run the whole variety from vertical to horizontal and slightly deviated. In general, they're vertical, but you know, there are cases where it's sort of a failed exploration well or something like that, and in that case, you know, it might be deviated or horizontal or things like that.
We're pretty close to the end of our time. Does anybody have a burning question? We can probably get time for a couple more. We'll go back to yes. Passive seismic. Is there a way to passively monitor everything? Let's say that. And I'm blown away, by the way, Richard, by the fact that a cell phone can tell the difference between an earthquake and a train going by or something like that.
It can. It's really cool technology. What can I tell you? So the clarification of what when you hear people like ourselves talk about active and passive seismology, usually what we're referring to, active seismology, it's about imaging techniques to see the subsurface, where we are actively putting the energy into the subsurface ourselves. So, shots, explosives, things like that, whatever it may be. So that would be the active seismology. So you put out your stations, you thump on the surface of the ground, and you record the vibrations. Passive seismology is everything else, which is about just putting out sensors and just recording the energy that you record from whatever source it may be. And so the traditional seismic networks that we have across California are passively recording earthquakes all the time. So when you hear there's a magnitude 5-point-something in California, it was, you know, that's an example of passive seismology. And as you say, the smartphones are doing exactly the same. So we try to do that. Obviously, it's better to do that, to just put out the sensors, record the ground shaking. But in some cases, when you want to have really detailed understanding of subsurface structure, taking the active approach is more useful.
And unfortunately, I think it's time to thank our panel. But come on up if you have additional questions. You'll be around for a couple of minutes, right, to answer questions? Okay, let's thank our panel then.